Somewhat ironically, one of the most challenging questions to answer in the current drug pricing debate is, how much does it cost? Is it the cost of the drug out of pocket? Perhaps the cost to the insurer, to the PBM, to the hospital, or to the final amount that ends up on the company balance sheet as revenue? To each of these value chain actors, the question can be markedly different. Stepping into this morass of complexity is Dr. Richard Evans, the general manager of SSR Health, which he founded in 2009 to make sense of the drug pricing debate. Before founding SSR, Richard was a senior analyst at Sanford C. Bernstein, and during his tenure was ranked both first in institutional investor in Bloomberg Market Analysis and rated as one of the top 20 stock pickers globally across all large cap industries. Richard, I'm a huge fan of your work, and it's great to speak to you today. Thanks for your hospitality.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dwayne.
So firstly, I think two of the best minds in the pharma business today are you and Jack Scannell.
Yeah, thank you.
Both of you were at Sanford Bernstein. That must have been really fun.
Yeah, it was. Jack's a great analyst and good collaborator still, and we still are in touch and do some work together. Have great respect for him. Bernstein was, kind of unfettered by investment banking, which is its classic sales point or differentiation point. And it's nice to just be able to do true analysis without bankers looking over your shoulder. So I think Jack and I enjoyed that, but it wears you out. I think we're both pretty wrung out by the time we left.
Well, consultancy does have a tendency to chew you up and spit you out.
It really does, yeah.
Yeah. But you guys did fantastic work. I mean,
Thank you so much.
Room's law and all of that.
Yeah, that one's all Jack.
Well, he doesn't say that. But, yeah. But fantastic analytical skills put in play. Obviously, you folks then went on and did other things. You founded SSR, and it was the core of your highly influential JAMA publication in March of 2019 that really caught my eye and many people. And it's this concept of the difference between what we see as pricing and where the debate lives and what the companies are actually seeing on their balance sheet. Can you explain the difference in these and distinctions between, you know, pricing, rebates, net, gross? I mean, what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the difference between list and net prices right now is about 48% on average, and there's a huge dispersion. You've got, especially some of the diabetes classes, with percentage differences or gross to net or GTN differences up in the 80s. And then you've got oncolytics that have, 8 to 15% gross to net percentages. So about 48% on average, sales weighted, but huge dispersion. And then when we talk about net, we are talking net of every concession that a manufacturer would make when they sell their product into the channel. So that's going to be the things that we typically think of, rebate, copayment assistance, but it's also going to have trade friction. So the prompt pay discount to wholesalers, the pricing concessions you make when you change price and give them inventory credits, provision for return goods, all that finds its way into that gross to net percentage. We've become more of a measurement company than an analysis and forecasting company now. And we felt it was possible to closely approximate net prices using publicly available data. There's a lot of work that goes into that,
sure.
A lot of analysis and cleaning and curating. But we wanted to measure that net price, show it. And, certainly there's utility to a lot of stakeholders to knowing the net price. But we also wanted to see that into the academic world, because a pharmacoeconomic discussion focused on list price in a world with average discounts of 48% is a meaningless discussion.
Well, we just did a podcast with Gary Branning from mm-hmm. Rutgers University. He does a lot of work for the PBMs,
sure.
Obviously. And he was pointing out that a lot of those rebates now are going to keep premiums down. And this is a concept that I think a lot of us don't think about. Mm-hmm. But the reality is 90, 95% of the people don't need these high-end prescription, cancer drugs, etc. So for the vast majority of the population, it's that $35 a month Medicare Advantage rebate that everyone's focused laser-like on.
Right.
Are we doing so at the behest of both healthy patients, and is this going to cause us long-term problems if we don't start dealing with the fact that maybe premiums are causing a lot of these issues?
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of potential pathologies with a rebate-based pricing system. The first is that the benefit of the rebate, unless it's applied to the point of sale for the individual patient, really goes to reducing premiums, to your point. But the thing is, the premiums are paid on average by people that are reasonably healthy, and the out-of-pocket is paid by people who are not. So instead of having the savings go to the people that need it most and the people that are experiencing illness, the savings from rebates typically go to reducing premiums, which to me is more of an ideological comment than an economic comment. I think that's a misallocation. I do think prices should be lower at the point of sale to the individual who needs the drug in that moment. So that's one rebate pathology. Another is it creates an enormous cash stream that doesn't necessarily engender the best behaviors, right? So right. It creates a lot of opportunities to do the wrong thing or to do things that may not be optimal. And there are a few examples of that. One is, if I'm a PBM or a health plan and I'm trying to decide which drug I want to prefer, I'm going to think carefully about which one gives me the most gross profit every time I administer a claim. And that's going to tend to be the one that has a larger rebate. And that's not a tilt in the system that we should want. And then on the manufacturer side, I can, potentially game that rebate by offering very low rebates to people that give me very large rebates to people that give me very large market share, but then quickly attenuating those rebates as I fall below even your very high market share levels, like 90-80%, sure. 75. And what that does is it really makes it very tough for the second, third, fourth product in the class to gain traction, even if they're at least as good and dramatically cheaper or substantially better clinically even. The whole rebate sort of base configuration or anatomy of drug pricing is pretty inefficient, to be honest.
What we saw when we were doing the HR3 analysis, when we started looking at the insulin class and started looking at, what you guys do, we started looking at those, balance sheet nets versus, mm-hmm. The income statement nets versus what we were seeing in Medicare. And, we were seeing 50, 60% reductions for the entire U.S. market for some of the insulin products. You see less than 50% net revenue compared to the price in Medicare. So it's like, wow, there's 50, 60% of sales here that are vanishing. And ironically, as you just said, or unironically, it sounds like, the one who offers the highest volume, you see the biggest spread in the price.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely right.
Obviously, there's a perverse incentive there to capture more market share. And our marketing director, Petra Naster, said, this obviously we're looking at the PBMs as the problem. Well, not actually. You're sort of picking up the insulin sales guy by the ankles and then beating up a PBM guy with him.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, we have to be open-minded and cautious. This whole debate is extremely polarizing and fractious, and it's a shouting match, right?
Sure.
Not just between the left and the right, but also amongst players in the industry. And the truth is everybody has a bit of blame, and I hope I don't lose clients saying that. But but honestly, I think, if we sit back from it and look at it objectively, everyone's kind of trading their own account, which is what you would expect, right? As economists or game theorists, we would expect, look, people are going to be rational, self-optimize. And when you do that, given the rules of this game and sort of the rebate-based architecture of the game, it leads to outcomes that society doesn't want or doesn't necessarily benefit from.
But all the actors are acting logically.
Everybody's acting logically, yeah. No doubt about that.
What I find fascinating about this is everyone's very happy to sort of make out the pharmaceutical industry as the black hat villain tying the lady to the railroad tracks.
Right.
But when you look at how the net's actually working on the pharmaceutical balance sheets over, particularly even during COVID, net profits now are down at 13-14% for the industry as a whole. I mean, this is lower than the soft drink sector.
Net prices for U.S. prescription brands have been falling for 4 years straight, 16 quarters. In nominal terms, before adjusting for inflation, after adjusting for inflation, the losses are obviously much greater, and they've been going on for more like 5 years.
Right, and now we're at 9%, right?
Right.
And that's what's so fascinating about the BBBA bill, which maybe we should touch on a bit.
Sure.
So essentially, we've got Congress now stepping in and saying, okay, we're going to force down, we're going to cram down pricing on drugs that should be genericized on mm-hmm. some level, although a lot of practitioners like those branded therapies because they work.
Yep.
And that's, again, that's between the practitioner, the patient, and their God. I mean, fundamentally, I don't like the Congress necessarily stepping in to start, strong-arming pricing. But what you see here in those prices when the Congress is moving in often it's not what's actually on the bill, as it were. It's about 50%, yeah, as you've pointed out. But also what you see is a preference for the extended therapies and some of these extended labels, because, again, it goes back to this rebate issue. And none of this is being discussed in this bill.
Right. Yeah, the other thing that seems to be missing from the architecture of the bill, and I don't want to go too far down the road. Well, I don't think I'm going to change the bill at this point, but
well, we're trying.
Yeah, exactly.
We're trying.
But one of the things I noticed is that, just as an example, drugs are fed into the negotiation queue based on spending, not on potential savings.
Right.
Sort of the minimum outcome of the negotiation is set at a certain gross to net threshold. And the truth is, a lot of the higher gross spending products already have gross to nets that are above the minimum threshold set by the bill. So if you, use your limited, negotiations in a particular time frame on a drug that is high spending but already has a gross to net that exceeds the minimum outcome from the negotiation, it's silly. You're just wasting your time. Now, everybody's going to go through that dance because, if I'm the manufacturer and I've got a, 65 gross to net product and the, maximum outcome is 60, set by the legislation, and I get called to negotiate it, I'm going to slow walk that process as long as I can.
Absolutely.
Right. I'm going to filibuster it. You soak up bandwidth so that they don't get to my next product.
Right.
Right. And I'm going to hope everybody else in the industry does the same thing, and likely they will.
But ultimately then the patient is going to be the loser.
Agreed. Yeah.
And what we've seen in Europe with these price differentials with the U.S., we've seen enormous impacts on biotech innovation in Europe. I mean, there's an exodus of mid to late stage biotech. We're still seeing early acquisition activity, but the marginal value of each individual deal is barely moved, where it's trebled in the United States. Deals gone from 3 million, 9 million on U.S. deals. Well, in Europe, it's gone from 2.8 million to 3.4 million, which just screams it's all early stage. So this is early stage stuff at being, moved and relocated primarily, 95% of the time to the U.S. Can we be so, I don't want to say pigheaded or arrogant, but I am going to say pigheaded or arrogant, that we think we're going to be able to absorb sort of mandatory pricing reductions, admittedly on the end of the value chain, but still these are highly revenue producing products that are going to zap, hundreds of billions of dollars of liquidity out of the market and not expect similar deleterious impacts on our innovation system.
Yeah, I do think there's an innovation impact. I think whenever we talk about the difference in capital formation, venture capital formation between the U.S. and Europe, we have to think about a lot of things, right? So we have to think about the university system in the United States, which is really second to none. We have to think about bankruptcy laws, which make this all more fertile ground for venture. And we also have to think about quantitative easing here over the last few years, right? There's a lot of money flowing around.
There's a lot of liquidity. If you have access to that 0% discount rate, my God.
You got it. Absolutely. Yeah. And so that has all been, the U.S. is relatively fertile ground for those reasons, not just for healthcare. But then when we get to healthcare, the discussion, as someone who talks to LPs quite a bit, is much easier here. When you talk about the European side of the model or the ex-US side of the model of demand for a drug, you're telling them, hey, we know the population, we know the disease rate, we know the treatment rate, we have, reasonable guesses about compliance, all these things, but I can't really tell you what the units are going to sell for. And any approximation I'm going to make is going to be based on the current market, right? So we're going to be going for unit share, not a price premium. And that kind of turns investors' interest towards what can happen in the U.S. And the U.S. so far has been a much more enticing discussion. All these patients, all these units, and we think that pricing, should be here. And it's more of a market-based price. If you change that discussion and say, look, we'll go through all these steps to get the product approved, and we believe we can get this type of unit share, but we have no idea what the price will be because it's going to be set, by the feds or by the state, you're killing capital formation. LPs are not going to put money into funds that are going to develop technologies that the principals have no pricing control over in the future. I honestly think this is one of the least well understood longer term impacts of price controls in the United States. So I'm not going to suggest that we're at a pricing equilibrium and nothing needs to be done and it's all good. I'm not saying that at all.
Sure.
I do believe that the system needs to be worked upon. But if you create a system architecture in which government can set prices by fiat, you chill investment, full stop.
And the problem is these are political decisions then. This is not based on reality. What you see in Europe now is this becomes politics. And we're just, you know, we are going to stand the line on drug pricing, and this becomes sort of a party slogan, as it were. It manifested itself in things like the COVID-19 vaccines, where they were very proud that they negotiated a price half as low as you had in the United States.
Right. Well,
that's great. And then what happened is they didn't get delivery until September of 2021 in some of these contracts. Meanwhile, you know, their economies are stopped. If you look at Belgium, and we ran the numbers on this, you know, Belgium saved, and I'll keep it, just use simple numbers. It's like $11 based on the euro exchange, but we'll say $10. So Belgium had $10 less per dose. That's $20. So you have 10 million people. They saved $200 million. In dosages at a cost of shutting the economy for 6.4 billion euros. Okay, that's stupid math. Okay.
Right. Yeah, it's not even close.
Yeah, but that's the reality of what these decisions are doing now. They're making decisions on political short-term budgeting and not looking at the long-term health economic impact of their society. This is what concerns me about the way some of the Congress and some of the rhetoric is going here.
I agree. So I think the a lot of the motive for drug policy is coming from the grassroots level, right? And so any person, Republican or Democrat, is likely to feel that they have a valid moral claim on effective therapy. And I tend to agree with that. I do think individuals have a valid moral claim to effective diagnosis and treatment. You know, my son's a resident. My daughter-in-law's a chief resident. They are now, thank God, financially independent. but, you know, they need money, right? So they provide care. They provide diagnostics. But they need to be compensated for that, right? There needs to be some fair payment. And I think that's where we as Americans start to get really squeamish, right? So, you know, yeah, we're going to provide that diagnostic or we're going to provide that treatment, and it's going to cost a certain amount. And I think instinctively we just say, that's not fair. Why? I have a valid moral claim to this. Why am I paying for it? And there are issues like, well, hey, you know, if there's a rebate paid on that, it should be at the point of sale, which, you know, I feel strongly about. But still, something has to be paid. And we're just so squeamish about talking
the real conversation.
Yeah, about the real economic impact of delivering diagnostics and treatments. I also think in policy circles we're naive, both on the left and on the right, about the impact of legislation or regulation.
If I can add, though, Richard, I mean, there's bipartisan support for what's going on the Hill right now, this BBBA bill.
Agreed. Yeah, the industry has no friends, right?
No, there's
absolutely no doubt about it. And it goes back to my point that at the grassroots level, Republicans and Democrats are upset about their out-of-pocket costs of pharmaceuticals, and I understand that. I've experienced those emotions myself. And so, you know, that gets to the boss in whatever district or state, and he or she is going to act on that politically, understand that. But we get into these crazy policies, like, and I'm not condemning the entire ACA here, but, you know, I remember back when the Obama administration was, you know, finally putting some energy behind sort of marketing the ACA and trying to get enrollment and things like that. And there just seemed to be this belief amongst the administration and its supporters on the Hill that people would, quote, do the right thing and enroll. And my partner and I did this simple analysis called carrier coverage. And we just looked at the marginal cost of someone who was subsidy eligible enrolling for coverage and what alternative purchase could have been made with the funds that they had used to gain coverage. And so for a lot of folks, you know, certainly closer to the 400 FPL than to the 100% of federal poverty level or the 150, it was basically a Toyota Camry, like a nice one, right, with automatic air, the whole bit.
Yeah, sunroof.
Yeah, exactly. And so our point was, you know, there are a lot of good things about the ACA. There are a lot of problems with the ACA, but you're kind of assuming that people are going to give up a Camry to buy healthcare. That's just not a slam dunk, right? And they're not going to do it for ideological or political reasons. I mean, give me...
That's real money, Richard.
It's real money. Yeah. So, you know, give me the most ardent Obama supporter. You know, they're going to think twice about spending that much money for healthcare, especially if they're 20 or 30 and don't think they're going to need it.
Forever.
Forever. Right.
Now, getting back to the out-of-pocket costs and that deductible that we're talking about in Medicare, if you go back and read the Medicare Part D bill. And I did. I actually sat down and read the damn thing one day. Sat there over a weekend and read the bill. It's like, what was going on? I know I'm a glutton for punishment. But like, you know, client is king, Richard. Client is king. But you know, it was really interesting when you actually read the bill, when you start to understand what the logic was at the time. And fundamentally, if you put this in the context of Hatch, Waxman, and Bayh-Dole, I mean, there's a whole bunch of decisions that were made to improve pharmaceutical competitiveness in the U.S. and bring the biotech sector to the forefront and really provide a competitive advantage and an incentive system to promote U.S. biotech innovation. You know, this was the onset of personalized medicine, stratified therapies, genetic gene-based marker therapies, and the U.S. now dominates that sector globally. There's no question. And the bill made specific allocations and specific provisions that it was designed to improve the transfer of innovation, the translation of new science from the bench to the general public and to the patient very rapidly. I mean, it's actually stated in the bill several times. The problem is that 5% catastrophic out-of-pocket cap, Lipitor was the number one selling drug back then, under $2,000. Okay. Yep. Now we're into targeted oncology products and things like that that are, you know, $100,000. BBBA does have a hard cap of $2,000. Great.
Right.
But now they've sort of packed on a whole bunch of other goods and bells and whistles that are potentially going to be extremely damaging. Shouldn't we be focused on where the pain point is for patients? Isn't that really the issue here?
It is. So I think the sort of the share of payments for a typical, or not a typical, or I guess now an increasingly typical Part D patient, one that it crosses a CAT threshold, really does not make sense. You know, to your point, you know, and as you well know, once you pass CAT threshold, the you know share of who pays what really just falls on the treasury, and ultimately that's not sustainable. And the incentives are completely upside down out beyond the CAT threshold, because as long if you're the payer, as long as I, the manufacturer, am giving you at least 15% concession, you're probably indifferent or even happy to have that drug consumed by the patient beyond the CAT threshold. And so while we want to make these products available for patients who are exceeding the CAT threshold, and we want them to be affordable to these patients, you don't want to have patients that are getting treated simply because it's profitable to the provider.
Right.
That's, and I do think we're there. I mean, not to get way off track, but, you know, one of my good friends, he's an actuary, showed me, you know, sort of Medicare treatment data by zip code. And, you know, the chances of pathology from being overtreated in Palm Beach are non-trivial. Right. So anyway, I'm getting off track, but
it's a valid point. And because also oncology products, since the Reagan administration, they act as wholesalers too.
Yeah.
We were with a client and they said, you know, we want to be bold about oncology pricing. We want to be bold. I'm like, how bold? Very bold. We want to be very bold. I'm like, well, okay. All the oncologists are cramming down on you about pricing. Why don't you start going after them about wholesale pricing? Not that bold.
Right.
We didn't mean that. No. Exactly. Maybe not that bold. You know, they do act as wholesalers, and there's been tons of studies that show that they're more inclined to use stuff. You know, there is this, not all of them, and there's not all bad actors, but there's certainly a predilection there.
Absolutely, there is. Yeah, so it gets back to this notion that we started on, which is the real world impact of policy is going to be different than people anticipate, especially when the origins of that policy are more ideological than economic.
Which is exactly what we're getting with this bill now with BBBA.
I think so too.
Unfortunately. And there seems to be as you had sort of alluded to earlier, there seems to be a misunderstanding that, well, just because these are supposed to be generic, we can then sort of put a pricing control on, and that's great. Then we're just going to force, you know, genericized pricings down on drugs that maybe the market demand is actually really high. And these are still, some companies, we're seeing 20, 30% of their gross revenue on these products.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think the generic market is, well, there are and have been major problems with the generic market, but this bill does nothing to treat that. I think the hyperinflation period of 2013, 2015 in the generic market was collusion, pure and simple. Mm-hmm. There's more to it than meets the eye, even. in the even in the class settlement. So I think there are structural problems in the generic market, but the prices are quite low. If we're looking at this from a treasury perspective or an access to medicines perspective, you know, the problems with the generic market would be we need generics sooner, right?
Sure.
You know, so we, you know, evergreening and things like that, I think are real potential problems and things that can be addressed. But I just don't think BBB does any of that.
And the big issue about that specifically, the bill is sort of saying, making an assumption, okay, we're going to jam down and force down these prices, so then that's going to force generics. There's no restrictions on the PBMs at all. Mm-hmm. And if you're a PBM and you, as we discussed earlier, you're flowing through 50, 60% to keep rebates on the premiums, you're not going to put that generic in there. Or if you're going to take your branded generic now that was 4x higher,
yeah,
5 years ago, you're still going to expect that revenue because you need that to keep those premiums down. And if not, you're going to switch to a branded selling product that has time release or something like that, that still has a label.
That's exactly
you're
right.
Just gonna, yeah. You're just going to switch.
Well, you're seeing that in the insulin market with Semglee and Basaglar, right? So one of the essential rules of drug pricing is to keep an eye on the gross profit that the intermediary makes when they touch your product, whether it's a wholesaler, retailer, physician-administered setting, payer, PBM. If they're making gross profit, you know, on product A, treating this patient today, and you want to come in there and displace product A with product B, then the gross profit that you're offering per claim or per touch has to be at least as high as it is on product A, and preferably higher.
Right.
And that, you know, certainly plays out when I'm launching a brand against an existing brand, but it also applies at the death of the brand when generics become an alternative. In many cases, those gross profits are higher and the intermediaries are perfectly happy, but that's going to be tested. It's going to be tested in, you know, first quarter when we see adalimumab biosimilars. There have been enormous, you know, dollar concessions on Humira. And whether or not the biosimilars and interchangeables to adalimumab can offer that type of dollar concession will determine whether or not they get any uptake.
And that's sort of the irony of the bill, the BBBA bill, is that it was written specifically. If you read the bill, it's like, okay, this is going after Humira. That's basically what it is. And the irony is here, by the time this bill, if it is passed, is put into action, you know, we're going to have 6 biosimilars for Humira in 5 months.
We're going to know so much more about biosimilar pricing a year from now, right? We do this for a living, and yeah, the number of potential outcomes in the adalimumab market are dizzying.
Yeah,
you know, not that I would suggest that, you know, Congress should just go home and wait and see what happens to adalimumab, but honestly,
we could hope. We could hope.
I don't think that'll happen. But we'll all be a lot smarter about the market a year from now than we are today.
We've spent a lot of time on BBBA, but obviously it's a hugely important issue. So, and it's top of mind right now. One of the other things about this bill, which is fascinating, you know, 3 months ago when it came out, you know, there was a whole bunch of stuff about PBMs and all the insulin and all this stuff. And funny, you know, 2 weeks ago, oh wow, it's not there anymore.
Right.
What a surprise. Why are the PBMs always getting off scot-free in this stuff?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is the insulin bill, I think, had its own problems. And I won't profess to know them as well as my friend Marta Wasinska and her collaborator, Richard Frank. I did see, you know, some of the thoughts they had on the bill, and they had done a much deeper dive than I had, and I tended to agree that what was going on there was probably not quite rational, and I do think they have a fair bit of heft on the Hill. So I think maybe Marta and Richard took some wind out of the sails of the insulin initiative. I don't know. But back to the bigger question, I don't think staff know what to do with PBMs. I think that, you know, going back to our prior point that, you know, nobody's hands are perfectly clean in all this, so you know, a comprehensive solution, you know, to drug pricing would involve changes, you know, for all actors, and including payers, including, of course, PBMs. I think PBMs are highly complex, very hard to figure out, right? We don't have capital markets reporting on any of them anymore, like we used to. So it's very hard to get transparency. And I think the typical staffer who deals with this, or the typical member of Congress, says, you know, hey, look, you know, these guys have been a pretty effective counterweight against drug price inflation. Love them or hate them. You know, again, like I said, net prices have been falling for 4 years. Most of that is formulary exclusions and copay accumulators, maximizers, optimizers. Some of that is loss of exclusivity, but most of that is formulary managers.
Yeah, design.
They've been hugely effective. So do I, as a staffer, want to pull them out of the fight? You know, if I oversimplify and say, okay, I'm gonna make PBMs fight with one hand tied behind their back, all else equal, I expect drug prices to go up. I think that's the fear. I think, you know, the typical staffer, left or right, would say, you know, hey, look, they've been effective in lowering drug prices. I may not like the way they operate. I may not like some of the incentives that they're responding to and how they're responding to them, but I don't know how to replace them.
But shouldn't some of the rebates be going to point of sale as opposed to going to premiums? I mean, wouldn't that make sense?
So.
Isn't that more morally justified, at least?
I think so. But ultimately, I tend to think of myself as a free market economist. If the payers, the ultimate player, the payers, the plan sponsors want that, they can get it.
Yeah, of course.
Right? So, you know, I think we have to be a little careful. Yeah, I'm not carrying anybody's flag here.
Of course.
Right? Again, I think everybody's got...
an ox to gore, as they say.
Absolutely. But I do think, you know, hey, if GE, GM, you know, John Deere, Ford, AT&T, you know, these folks want rebates at the point of sale, they could have it next quarter.
Sure.
I do think it should be there, but I you know, I'm frustrated by the fact that it would... Administratively, the systems are there, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's just that
Trump had a couple bills and tried to do a couple executive orders, and you know, they always got unwound somehow.
Yeah, and the problem is it pushes the premiums higher.
Yeah, well, right? Okay.
Yeah, and even word choice. I mean, when there was this movement to basically hold the PBMs to a fiduciary standard, and just using the word fiduciary in the wake of the 08 CMO crisis. It was toxic, so you couldn't get members or staff past
right.
The fiduciary word, right? So that kind of killed
the F word.
Yeah, the F word, right? And that wasn't my initiative. We weren't there fanning the flames on it, but it was curious that one week I'm down in D.C. and, you know, answering questions and trying to provide some technical support and, you know, using words like fiduciary, and the next week I'm down there and I'm not allowed to use that word anymore. Because it's not, yeah.
Not apropos.
Yeah, it's not apropos.
Changing gears a little bit, you and I met on a panel about 5 months ago, 4 months ago, about some of the wonderful and joyous things coming out of CMS regarding reforms of reimbursement based on accelerated approvals, which is extremely problematic. We have sort of a pointing match between FDA and CMS, where CMS is basically saying, we're not going to trust your evidence anymore, and we're going to start making reimbursement decisions, or at least there were. What do you think was motivating CMS to make this decision, aside from the fact this would have been a very expensive Alzheimer's drug? But in general, is this a path we should start going down?
Not with CMS. And I don't mean any disrespect to CMS when I say that, but they're not configured as a body that should do HTA or health technology assessment. You know, one suspects that they felt they had to, you know, staring down the barrel of aducanumab and what that would mean at its original price, even at its new price,
sure.
given the demographics, the number of patients that would qualify. So I honestly don't think it was the right thing to do. I believe organizations should stay in their lane, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a lane defined for CMS. They're quite good at it. I have immense respect for CMS, but I think they should stay in that lane, and HTA is not part of it. Setting that aside, I do believe that HTA is important. As I stressed at the beginning, we're no longer a forecasting and analysis company as much as we are a measurement company. And as a measurement company, you have to find the best possible approximation of the underlying truth that you can and provide that to your clients, whether it's good news, bad news, leans to the left, leans to the right, whatever. You can't care. You just have to measure things and find them. And so we try not to bring a lot of biases to the market, but I do always bring one, which is that I think the current pricing system is not at equilibrium. I think the appropriate equilibrium for drug pricing is for prices to relate to value.
Sure.
Right? So if we think about prices in the broader economy, price quantity, price quality links, discipline price, pretty much everywhere else in the economy, they don't do that here. It is very hard to do it using market forces because elasticities are distorted. You're paying with other people's money, all the things we know.
Sure.
It's very hard to do it with administrative power. Because I can't imagine the individual or the institution that has the ability to keep pace with all the price points within a healthcare system, and much less pharmaceuticals alone. But I still believe we have to link price to value. To do that, my feeling is that we need to drug pricing what the Fed is to interest rates and the money supply. If you politicized interest rates and the money supply, imagine where we would be, right?
Well, I think we'd be right where we are now, unfortunately.
I think we'd be in a worse, even slower reacting version of where we are. So it's a long way of saying I do think we need HTA. I drafted a book on this where, I kind of attacked it after I left Bernstein and said, okay, sure. How do you really fix the healthcare system, get pricing right? Is it market forces? Is it administrative forces, et cetera, et cetera? And unfortunately, it's I think that's just a tug of war over two wrong answers.
There's HTA and there's HTA, right? Because if you look at what's happened with European HTA, they're basically just a cudgel to try and hold pricing down now for the government. What's funny, if you go back and look before Europe put in the centralized procedure, basically you had the national procedure, which then could be adopted by the community. So Zeneca does a clinical trial in Sweden. You have the Swedish practitioners who are involved in the clinical trial then go and then sit on the evaluation committee. And you actually saw some very fast approvals, 2-3 years ahead of FDA on occasion. You saw the same in France. So you'd see the clinicians, similar to what happens with FDA. It's the actual practitioners who sit on the advisory committee. These are experts, subject experts. And there's a dialogue and there's an interplay between the knowledge centers of regulatory and actual practice on the clinical trials. And it seemed like the system worked a little more adaptive to the clinical realities of the products.
Right.
What's happened in Europe now is you have bureaucrats who are paid by the state. Many of them are PharmDs, and they're certainly very good at their job, but they're not clinical trialists. Most of them, I'd say, are not clinical trialists. And what you've seen is a huge change in the way the evaluation goes. It's a much more bureaucratic, and it's a much more price-based, not necessarily patient-driven process.
Right.
If you look at the debates in Europe, particularly around the hepatitis C Sovaldi drug, they called that immoral. People were making a moral argument about the price of the drug. If you did not use hepatitis C Sovaldi, you were looking at $200,000 by the time you started annuitizing the 1 in 5, 1 in 10 risk of a liver transplant, which was required because the other pathway, pegylated interferon, wasn't that great.
Right.
But the reality was that still saved a heck of a lot of money.
Right.
That was never taken into account in the debate, unfortunately.
Right.
How do we make sure that if we are talking real value, that actually is really accounted for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't, someone observing the Sovaldi launch and not really, being in the healthcare community or in the health economic community, much less the drug pricing community, would look at that and just say it's crass, it's excessive. I personally think the price was fair.
I do too.
But we have to think about how this plays out at the grassroots level, here and in Europe. And certainly in Europe, it played very poorly at the grassroots level. And the HTA apparatus was responding to that. I think that's the pressure from the below. The pressure from above is to hold healthcare spending constant as a percent of GDP. And there's not a lot of room for that in an aging population. But
to that point, OECD says that healthcare costs need to increase about 2% per year just to keep pace with the demographics. And that's not happening in Europe at all.
Absolutely. And I know some of the HTA folks in Europe and have worked with them and am fully aware that they have been told by their finance ministers, I'll be very nonspecific about which ones, that spending has to be held within a certain range. And drug price decisions get made as a result of that. And these are, it kind of isolates drug spending away from the rest of the economy, which I think is an insane thing to do, right? Back to your broader point about
it puts it in a box without contextualizing it with the actual hospital
process. Exactly, right. So if your finance minister says, hey, look, we can't afford that, we can't do it because it's just going to kill the budget this year. Well, okay, what if we spread it out over 2 years or 3 years or 4 years? We'll create a pyramid of who gets treated first, the most likely to progress to liver transplant, the most likely to be aided by Sovaldi, things like that. Look at the savings. It makes sense. Let's do it. That would be, I think, a very productive and useful outcome. That's not what we got. This is the number of patients. This is the price. We can't afford that. You've got to work within this healthcare percent of GDP cap. You've got to push it lower. Again, with an aging population, healthcare as a percent of GDP wants to rise.
Sure.
You're really spending a smaller and smaller percent of the economy on healthcare generally and health technology specifically than you probably should, because you're not you're trying to isolate healthcare spending and not link it to, or even drug spending and not link it to broader healthcare spending, or healthcare spending and not link it to the broader economy. To me, an HTA body, again, you know, like the Fed, you know, we can't say it doesn't respond to grassroots pressure, but it certainly isn't as swayed by grassroots pressure as Congress.
That is Congress's job, though, I suppose.
Really. It is, really.
And the Senate's supposed to be a buffer against that. Now we're
exactly.
That's not working.
That used to happen. Yeah, so I don't know. I personally have come to the conclusion, and I'm open-minded. I realize I could be wrong, but I've come to the conclusion that you can't solve drug pricing with market force alone. You can't solve drug pricing with administrative power alone. You know, trying to pull from examples that have demonstrated utility and demonstrated an ability to sort of rise above the grassroots fray and apply academically rigorous, sound, logical, forward-thinking policy. The Fed is the closest I can get. I'm not going to say it's an ivory tower without its problems, but it's, I think, a better example for drug pricing than any alternative I can think of.
And the problem we're seeing now with this short-termism thinking and this sort of putting healthcare in a box, particularly pharmaceuticals in Europe, you know, you're having cannibalizing activity around hospital-exempted CAR Ts, where they're making them homebrew at the hospital level. They don't even account for the total cost. They don't measure the total cost of a stem cell transplant. It's just a balance transfer of 19,000 euros. Here you go, 19 grand.
Yeah.
When we've done the ICD code linkages to the HCPCS, the HCPCS codes, and looked at, you know, apples to apples, and you're talking a couple $100,000. That's a very labor-intensive hospital activity that just goes on the overheads of the hospital. It's very easy to make a stem cell transplant look cheaper than CAR T when you're not counting the actual cost. It's a very easy way to do the math.
Right, right.
And this is the reality sometimes of where the HTA quotes, I'm doing air quotes, process goes.
Well, exactly. So that's too narrow a focus in two senses. One is you're not looking at the broader cost of obviously stem cell therapy, which has much more to do with labor and capital and things like that than it does with the ingredient. The other thing is, I think the manufacturers have made a mistake here, which is you're pricing these therapies as one and done, which to me is inefficient and illogical. So if I come to you and say, hey, look, I can save your eyesight, but I need $1 million need up front. I could probably save your eyesight. I need $1 million need up front. I'm going to inject your eyes. You know, it's going to be all good. You know, that may be a good proposition. It may be a good health economic proposition, but who's got $1 million?
Right.
And who's to say that, you know, hey, let's say that this injection has an 80% probability of working. There's one in the pipe that's got a 95% probability of working. Right. Should I wait? Well, if I've already spent $1 million, you know, I probably can't wait.
And then you get locked in on the technology as well.
Yeah. And if you get locked in on it, which is inefficient because we don't evolve that technology, it makes it, you know, tough on the competitor. So, you know, freeze frame that and think about, you know, Lipitor or, you know, whatever. The revenue stream to Pfizer from a Lipitor patient is a conditional annuity.
Right.
Right. If the patient continues to consume it, Pfizer continues to get paid. So Lipitor needs to work, and the patient needs to have, you know, the ability to pay for it and so on and so forth. But it's only going to be that patient's therapy for as long as it is the best option for that patient or one that patient freely chooses to consume.
And Lipitor was the fifth in the market, too.
Exactly right. That was actually efficient with respect to preference because it was plainly the best when it came in terms of efficacy. But if we, you know, price gene therapy the same way, right? So, hey, the upfront cost is, you know, $100,000, right, to get this started, this CAR T, and then you're going to pay $50,000 a year in perpetuity as long as, you know, these measurable benefits are being achieved, or you haven't regressed, or you haven't had to take a later technology that supplants the need for the original gene therapy, and you tie that future annuity not to the patient, not to the insurer, but to the reinsurer, so that that patient can still move from health plan to health plan. Because if you don't do that, right, there's no way a health plan wants somebody who's, you know, paying
an annuity tied to them when they bring them in. Absolutely.
Yeah, they'd never be able to shift healthcare. But a conditional annuity for a CAR T is a pricing anatomy that really reflects much more closely common brand pharma pricing anatomy than you're the one and done.
And there's a lot of data where serial CAR T, you know, multiple CAR T is actually appears to be quite potentially effective, right. Actually, you know, because you can use it, do it again and again. It does. Okay, yes, there's a toxicity profile, but certainly far less than a stem cell transplant.
You know? Yeah, and I think some of the gene therapies, certainly the adenovirus-based ones, you've got to be very, very cautious about, you know, second try, third try, things like that. But yeah, so not to go, you know, way down the road and try to sell conditional annuities, which I guess is my second major bias in drug pricing. But
as long as you admit it, that's fine.
It just demonstrates that I think there's some fairly simple, obvious, you know, right in front of our face options to make things more efficient that we're not taking advantage of.
Why aren't we doing it?
That's a great question. I think here it was a mistake by the manufacturers, and I know some of these manufacturers well, even personally, and. So it's not a value judgment at all. I just think it was a mistake. So if I were, you know, back in my job running a pricing function or a commercial operation and had the opportunity to bring a CAR-T to market, I would not do it as a one and done upfront price. I'd make it a conditional annuity. And to me, that was always the logical place to start. And it surprises me that we haven't started there or gone there.
It's a small market, though, too. That's the other problem. I mean, if you look at ALL and even B-cell lymphoma, you're talking several hundred, a handful, you know. Right. None of them are a blockbuster yet.
Right.
Although it's a promising technology that has multiple applications. You know?
Yeah, well, this goes back to another one of my principles about drug pricing. Never put the payer on the defensive. Or if you do have to put the payer on the defensive, be careful. Be so careful about it. So I used to always kind of visualize the meetings that my account managers were going into, both my national and my regional account managers, and how the other side would or even should respond. So if I come at you and say, hey, look, I've got this, you're probably going to have, you know, 10, 20 patients a year in your system. They're going to need this, and it's a million up front. If I'm the pharmacist on the other side or the VP of purchasing on the other side, I'm thinking, wow, there's going to be $1 million, you know, per single treatment. Therapy out there that my population is going to be asking for. Thanks for warning me. I'm going to build a brick wall right now. Right. And that's the PCSK9 story.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, right? And the fact that Lipitor had gone generic a few months before PCSK9 hit the market.
Yeah.
For the audience who doesn't know, PCSK9 was a gene therapy, a lipid lowering gene therapy that would have been a gene therapy replacement for Lipitor. But the problem was Lipitor basically became free.
Right.
And PCSK9 came out, and it did have superiority, clinical superiority, about 20-25%.
Yeah, even for the patients that, there are quite a few patients that fail to achieve their goals with statins, either because of compliance, because of side effects, or because their goals are just too high, right? So, or their LDLs are just too high. So there were millions of patients, you know, for whom PCSK9s were and are appropriate. And the... Yeah, the mortality data on them were not great, I'll admit, but if I remember correctly, it's like 0.7% reduction in MACE or major adverse cardiovascular.
It was a 3-year arm. You know, it's hard to know. It's hard to know.
Yeah, but if you take that 0.7 and you just say, okay, well, let's set that aside or let's put it in context. What was the percent MACE reduction for ACEs or for statins? It's about, I forget which one's which, but one was 1%, the other one was 70 basic points.
Exactly.
And so, and think about, you know, ACE inhibitor or blood pressure ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers and diuretics and statins are almost in the water supply.
Yeah.
Right. They're so broadly used. So you have PCSK9s that have really very comparable weight of clinical evidence and they have gone nowhere.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Because the pitch from the manufacturer was, hey, look, this thing's going to be, I forget what the original was, like 15?
$5 billion a year in sales is what I saw.
What was the price? The price originally, like, it was like 15 grand. Can you imagine being the pharmacist or the VP of purchasing on the other side of that equation? And we ran the NHANES numbers, right, just to see how many patients are out there that have taken statins. They have the requisite diagnoses. Their LDLs are not where they need to be. And they have had an ambulance ride, right, as a result of this. And let's just treat those patients, and you get into the tens of billions of dollars in spending. And so what formulary managers naturally did is they built a brick wall and said, okay, you know, pause right there. And now we're in control. We're going to titrate patients into this market at a speed we choose rather than just letting every patient that qualified according to the trial have access to it.
It was an interesting case. I like to use it as an example of just because you have IP doesn't mean you're going to guarantee sales.
Absolutely right.
Because, yeah. And you can have a good product. Sometimes things just don't work. You know, about 20% of all drugs that are released end up showing zero sales.
Yeah.
You know, that's the reality. If you take a big cohort and you look at everything approved and then look at what's actually selling, you got about 20%, one in five, that just go nowhere.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. People don't understand that. The other thing about PCSK9 was, obviously, from the behavior of the firms who were releasing them, you know, they were going to court against each other to try and hold each other back. I mean, they thought, I think by all the behavior, they thought this was going to be
enormous. I thought it was going to be.
Me too?
I absolutely did. This was a commercial failure rather than a scientific failure. And it actually marks, I think, a very important episode in which the population lacks access to
a highly effective treatment
because it's a commercial problem. So talk to your primary care provider and ask him or her if they would write you a prescription for PCSK9. I'm going to tell you they won't do it because it's triplicate. You've got to go through all this trouble. And so if it looks like you're going to need one, they're probably going to turf you to the cardiologist.
Right.
And the cardiologist wants a nice relationship with your primary care practitioner. So the cardiologist's office will try on their behalf to get you a PCSK9. They'll resent the primary care practitioner for sending you, but they'll try to get it for you, and they will probably fail. As a former product manager, one of your darkest fears is that you screw up the launch. And prescribers get used to not using your product.
Yeah.
They know it's there. They know the clinical story. They've tried to use it, and they couldn't get the prescription approved or couldn't get it filled, and they're not going to try again.
So, Richard, we got so much going on here. Yep. There's so many things. All attacks on all sides. I've never seen a sector. I've worked in the music business. I worked in media. I've done market analysis for tons of organizations. I don't ever remember a situation that's in so much turmoil as the pharmaceutical and biopharma sector as it is right now. Where do you think we end up a year from now? Where does this go?
Yeah. A year from now.
I know. It's next month.
I know. Exactly. we'll see what happens with BBVA. I think that... the primary parliamentary risk on reconciliation is getting to the floor with a measure that can still be line item edited. Because as you know, the reconciliation debate rules allow up or down votes on individual elements of the text, whereas typically when you're doing an up or down vote on the floor, it's for the bill, for the amendment. You don't get the line item edit. Under the Byrd rule, debate can effectively line item edit. So to prevent that, obviously what backers of the bill are doing now is having it birdbathed by the parliamentarian to try to eliminate such potential challenges. So we'll see where that goes. We'll see if they can get it passed. I suspect they can, honestly, whether we, folks like it or not, I do suspect that they will be able to get that passed and set into motion.
That's going to be huge, man. The numbers are huge.
I know. They really are. So I think we're going to be living with that. We won't really know the impact of that until it really hits, right? So,
3 to 5 years from now, we'll know.
Exactly, yeah. Right. We saw how long it took. Gosh, I mean, how long it took CMS to publish AMP, right? After
it was done on stone tablets, I think.
Yeah, exactly. After the ACA,
papyrus.
They were so late, right? So that we still have rulemaking and all that to go through. So I think we'll know that we have BBVA, but we won't know, and we'll have good analyses like yours on the potential impact, but we won't really feel it yet. I think the two biggest shocks in the next year are adalimumab biosimilar and interchangeability. Far and away, I think that really puts focus on incentives in the pharma value chain, adoption rates of biosimilars, prescribing behavior, the impact of rebates and losing access to rebates. I think that's going to be wildly informative. And then I think the other wild card is the copay maximizer. So we went through the accumulator, we went through the optimizer, but now the maximizer, just for viewers' benefit, you show up at the pharmacy and you have a prescription for a certain product. That pharmacist, the out-of-pocket that you're going to owe for that is just going to assume that you have a copay card from the manufacturer. And if you don't, they'll go get one for you. And so that allows the formulary manager to effectively vacuum up any copayment support that the manufacturer would provide and use that either for the benefit of the patient and or to lower premiums. And so where, copayment support had really been geared to be used selectively and partially, now every copay card gets vacuumed up and its full value gets taken off. And that air pocket of pricing really is hard to overestimate. So, we saw the accumulators, which hit early 18, early 19, as more people in those new benefit years came into scope of the accumulators, depressed net prices by, 2-3% market-wide. And that is a fraction of the impact of maximizers.
Right.
So, I think the more beneficiaries that wind up in plans that use copay maximizers, the more rapidly we're going to see price erosion, and potentially in elements of the market we haven't seen it before. Kinase inhibitors, for example, probably the most vulnerable sort of facet of the whole oncolytic space. So we're going to start to see price pressure in corners of the market we haven't seen it before, and it's going to come from copay maximizers.
Well, I hope a year from now we can sit down and have this conversation.
And I hope I'm wrong. I hope we have the conversation, but I hope that prediction was
Richard, wrong. Richard, it's been really great. Thank you very, very much for your time.
My pleasure, Dwayne.
The executive producer of the Vital Health Podcast is Dwayne Schultes. Our editor is Jonathan Ballin. Our project manager is Gwen O'Loughlin. This Vital Health Podcast is a production of Vital Transformation, LLC, copyright 2022.